I'm Jonathan Capehart, and welcome to Capehart. American Fiction is a sharp satire about a disgruntled novelist who writes a pandering narrative rife with black stereotypes that becomes an accidental success. Jeffrey Wright, who plays that disgruntled novelist, is nominated for the Oscar for Best Actor for his leading role in the film, which is nominated for the Oscar for Best Picture, a film The Post calls a racial parody rooted in wincingly familiar honesty. In this conversation, first recorded for Washington Post Live on February 23rd, Jeffrey Wright gets into how American Fiction fits into our nation's ongoing and tortured conversation on race.
We in America lack a fluency in race. We don't have conversations well around these issues. We have discourse that is difficult and fearful and stunted, and therefore we tend very often to be unproductive. At least within our film, you don't have to be afraid. You can come in, take it in, and you can laugh at us, you can laugh at yourself, and maybe come out it at the end with at least a fresher take on all of this madness.
Jeffrey, welcome to Capehart on Washington Post Live.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you. Really, really pleased to be here. The Washington Post also said that we were the best film of the year, so that was pretty cool as well.
Yes. Well, I mean, the Washington Post doesn't lie, Jeffrey. You know that.
Understood.
All right. So your character's name is Thelonious Monk Ellison. A lot of symbolism in that name. An author who is creatively stifled. As we saw in the intro, when his agent says publishers wanted a black book, quote, black book, he says, quote, they have a black book. I'm black and it's my book. Why isn't Monk's work considered black enough?
Well, as written, Monk tends to focus on things that are of interest to him. Things that satisfy his intellectual curiosities. One of the books that he has written is kind of a reconsideration of Greek mythology. And as is said in the script, the publishers are struggling to understand what that has to do with the black experience. So it's very simple. He doesn't fit into kind of a preconceived understanding of what a black mind wants to express. And so he's not seen for who he is. What I think is wonderful about our film and about that aspect of our story is that it's not simply confined to the experiences of black people. I think everyone wants to be seen as they are. Everyone wants to be perceived honestly. And so I think there's a universality within his frustrations, but within our film, yes, it certainly centers on the fact that he is a black man trying to be free creatively, and he's not necessarily received for who he is by a publishing world that in this case suffers from certain biases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to that point, since you mentioned the scene, we have the scene of you. I think this is the scene of you in the bookstore when you go looking for your book. Well, Monk is looking for his book. Watch this.
Excuse me, Ned. Do you have any books by the writer Thelonious Ellison?
Yeah, this way. Here you go.
Right. Yeah. Wait a minute. Why are these books here?
I'm not sure. I would imagine that this author, Ellison, is black.
That's me. Ellison.
Yeah.
He is me, and he and I are black.
Oh, bingo.
No bingo, Ned. These books have nothing to do with African-American studies. They're just literature. The blackest thing about this one is the ink.
I don't decide what sections the books go in, and no one here does. That's how chain stores work.
Right. Ned, you don't make the rules.
gonna put them back after you leave.
Don't you dare, Ned. Do not you dare.
What I love about that scene, Jeffrey, is that, you know, you can see the frustration in Monk. Why am I wrote about mythology. Why am I not in the section of mythology? And yet there is this cramped view of who Black people are, who they can be. In this case, it's literature. And so the publishing world, or at least the bookstore world, has decided, well, you're Black, Monk is Black, no matter what he's writing about, therefore he goes into either Black studies or African-American culture or whatever they're calling it in the bookstore these days.
That's right. You're Black, and therefore that is that provides the parameters for who you are, and you can be nothing more than that, nothing outside of that. I think what the issue is that we in America lack a fluency in race. We don't have conversations well around these issues, so we tend to miss the mark either when we're trying to generate progress, or when we're just generally trying to problem solve together. We have discourse that is difficult and fearful and stunted, and therefore we tend very often to be unproductive. But Monk's frustrations begin very early in this film, and it kind of sets up an understanding of who he is. But it begins our film with a conversation that's being had across the country, in classrooms across the country. The film starts, he's a professor, he's teaching Flannery O'Connor's book, The Artificial Nigger. That's the name of the book. Southern Gothic writer writing about, it's a short story, strange short story. Nonetheless, that verboten word is on the white wall behind him. A student in the classroom takes offense at this, and the whole conversation blows up. That's a conversation that's being had and has been had in classrooms across our country and outside of of the classroom as well. And so we think that this is really timely stuff, which is why the film has kind of intrigued audiences. So his frustrations begin early. But actually, I was doing I received an award in London recently named after Dillis Powell. Dillis Powell was the film critic for the London Times. And I was wondering if she had written in any of her reviews about issues related to our film. I was wondering if she had written about Othello's, about Laurence Olivier's Othello, 1965. Of course, he performed in blackface. She had not. But what I stumbled onto was an article from a few years ago at the University of Michigan, where a teacher who was teaching the adaptation of classical literature into opera, a Chinese-born teacher named Bright Sheng, had the apparently incredibly poor judgment to show Olivier's Othello in his class. The classroom erupted. He was forced ultimately to step down from teaching that course. Now, I don't know if he understood necessarily the nuances of that film and of that tradition, but we could have very much started the film with that scene. And what I found disturbing about it was that you have now, in that instance and other instances, a younger generation that's afraid to have a conversation around the history of race and representation in our country, and you have another segment, older perhaps or not, of our country that wants to be dismissive of this history entirely as though it did not exist. For me, what we need to do is to take in this history so as to understand it and therefore perhaps understand better who we are and have better discourse and more constructive discourse around these issues. And then, wow, perhaps even we can generate some progress around them. Mm-hmm. So yeah, our film at times is kind of documentary. It's not so fictional at all.
Yeah. Well, right. And on that issue of how our culture particularly our American culture when it comes to race, lacks fluency, gets us to why Monk ends up deciding there in his house, this is what the people want, I'm going to write this book. And as we saw in the intro screen, you start writing out my pathology, and then you think, no, my pathology, and then you just cram it with all these things. And after it becomes, and you just do it on a lark and send it to your publisher, basically a cathartic experience, just getting it out of you. Your publisher calls and says they want to buy it, and then it becomes a hit. And then you say at one point, they look at what they publish, look at what they expect us to write. I'm sick of it. And that's an expression of how sick I am when you hand in my pathology. In terms of our culture lacking the fluency to have these conversations on race, how does American fiction engage that conversation?
Well, we do it fearlessly. That's the first thing. We're not afraid to have these conversations. And as well, we're not afraid to have a laugh while doing it,
right.
which provides a kind of welcoming atmosphere to anyone really across backgrounds to join us. I think somewhat, perhaps, although not entirely, in the vein of, you know, Mel Brooks and his type of satire. Mel Brooks spoke at an event recently that I attended, and he said that, you know, satire is worthless if it's not commenting on the politics and the social environment of the times. Yeah, we're doing it in a way we hope that's inviting. And while inside of our film are difficult conversations and conversations that don't necessarily go well, at the same time, Cord Jefferson, who wrote and directed this and adapted this from Percival Everett's erasure, Percival as well, and Cord, do understand these things and are fluent in the way they observe them and in the way they write about them. So we think at least within the 2 hours of our film, we can maybe have a slightly more elevated, dare I say, slightly smarter kind of take on these issues. And again, you know, why not have a good time while we're doing it? Hey, can I say one more thing about that that Othello piece?
Sure.
As I started to dive down, and this gets back to our lacking fluency, because we don't understand the origin, or we want to dismiss out of fear or whatever reasons the origins of who we are. So I started to dive down into the Othello piece and the blackface piece, because it does. It is related to our film in that our film ultimately is not confined to the publishing world, but what we're talking about is representation generally, whether it be in the media or in the real world as we walk down the street. How is it that we are perceived? So I went back, as it relates to film, of course, the origins of Black representation are blackface. Burt Williams, incredible artist, absolute inspiration to me, who made his first full-length film in 1913, a year before Charlie Chaplin made his first short film. But Burt Williams was a Black man who performed in blackface. He was absolutely brilliant. If you have an opportunity, it's a silent film called A Natural Born Gambler, 1916. He does a pantomime routine of a poker game that is absolutely delicious. I stole from that when I performed in Top Dog Underdog on Broadway. But looking back to the origins of this thing, and what I came to understand was that there was a guy named T.D. Rice, who in the mid-19th century was known as the father, or became known as the father of minstrelsy, a white guy who performed in blackface. And he was the one who really popularized that idea or that mode of performance. It had existed before in the culture, but he was the one who really, you know, kind of made it central to the theatrical experience, this blackface thing. Do you know where apparently he first saw it? Blackface?
Where?
Or the first blackface performances in America were? They were from British Shakespearean troops doing Othello. In fact, the only known drawing from Shakespeare's time of one of his plays was of Titus Andronicus, and within that is an actor in blackface playing Aaron the Moor. So it allows us, if we take in the history in this way, to at least find the breadcrumbs along the way as we do the detective work that help us better understand how we got here. So you go from that, from a Shakespearean drawing of Titus Andronicus, you make your way to mid 19th century America, you make your way to Burt Williams, the beginnings of American cinema, but also the beginnings of Black representation. And then you begin to understand how that informed the general understanding of who Black people were and how it informed cinematic representations going forward to our film. But if we don't do the dive back into the history, we're completely lost as to understanding how we got here and who we are. It doesn't just apply to film. It applies generally to an understanding not only of who Black people are in this country, but who we are generally as Americans. So I think that's a long-winded of saying explain why we lack fluency.
Right.
Because, listen, we're just, like, to be blunt, we don't want to be smart about it. And I think that has to do in some ways with how fearful we are of this stuff for whatever reasons. And again, at least within our film, you don't have to be afraid. You can come in, take it in, and you can, you know, you can laugh at us. You can laugh at yourself and maybe come out at the end with, at least a fresher take on all of this madness.
Well, you know, Jeffrey, we're at the point in our culture today where those breadcrumbs you were talking about, there are people actively knocking them out of the way, sweeping them out of the way, thinking that, you know, we don't need to see them, we don't need to pay attention to them. But there's another part of fluency that we should talk about. And you started alluding to it when you mentioned Cord Jefferson, who's also nominated for an Oscar for best writing adapted screenplay. And the two of you spoke about being intentional that American fiction not be a, and I'm quoting, classist dismissing of work that was beneath you, but rather talking about the broadening of representation. And it was this classist dismissing because, you know, if white audiences or the publishing world, in the case of American fiction, if all they respond to is not Monk's mythology book that he wrote, but they're responding to all of the pathology and my pathology, how were you able to be intentional to ensure that by doing that satire in my pathology, you're not dismissing the lives of people for whom some of those things are true?
Yes, sure. Absolutely. I think we did a couple of things. One was that we insisted that Monk, and he is in the book as well, be flawed. He's not necessarily the most reliable narrator. He goes through a process of self-reflection. He goes through a process of being checked, particularly by the women in his life. He's not the same man at the end of the movie that he is at the beginning. He's considered his flaws. He's considered perhaps some of the blind spots in his perspective. He's considered his own personal damage, and he's changed. I think that's optimistic. He's changed personally, and he's changed in terms of his understanding that perhaps there is space for all of these stories. I think our argument, too, is we're not saying these stories should not exist, but there's just a broader range of story to be told.
Right.
So that's one way in which we do we do this? There's also something that interesting that happens in that scene that you describe, in which he, you know, out of outrage decides to write My Pathology. He's writing in this mode that he, you know, is mocking, you know, that he considers dismissive. But at the same time, what he's writing about is a son confronting his father out of frustration, out of disappointment, out of confusion, out of anger. And there's some subtext within that that relates to his own experience with his father. His father having died by his own hand 7 years before the beginning of the film. So even as he's, being disrespectful to this genre of literature, at the same time, he's infused, at least within that scene that we show in the film, something of his own broken interiority, to use his own phrase. And so even in the act of trying to be dismissive, he actually is admitting that there is some value there, at least personally for him. So we hope that, you know, we're nuanced in this, and that certainly we're not spouting the gospel ourselves, that there's room for interpretation within our storytelling, and there's room for everyone. And I think, again, going back to having a good time with this, we don't take ourselves too seriously. We're kind of, as I said once before to you, we're throwing darts at everyone in the room, including ourselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a very important approach for us.
You know, as you were giving that answer, I was going back and thinking, you're talking about representation. And it's interesting because, you know, I'm watching the movie and, you know, and I'm watching Monk. And Monk reminds me so much of me, right down to the way Monk dresses. Mm. And there's Monk in a Martha's Vineyard, Sag Harbor like environment, and mm-hmm. all of the sort of class and everything things that represents while writing My Pathology. And it seems to me, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but just by having Monk be in that environment is also inviting the viewer to realize, you know, Black people go to the beach. Black people have beach homes and have this community of other Black people who also have beach homes. A view of Black life that we don't usually get to see in film.
That's right. Of course, you know, aside from the fact, of course, Jonathan, that, you know, I shaped the character based on you. you're absolutely right. But this is as well why we wanted to make sure that this wasn't solely a celebration of the Black bourgeoisie. Didn't want that at all. But we do that too because, yes, as you say, these are Black folks, you know, just doing the things that they want to do and they have access to. But at the same time, they're by no means perfect. This family that we see is as crazy as anyone else's family, is as flawed, is as beautiful, is as loving, dysfunctional at times, and inescapable. We wanted to make sure that we fleshed these people out in a fully human way. But I think what's most important in that regard, in fleshing out their humanness, is to show that, you know, they're far from perfect. Mm-hmm. But for me, that aspect of the film, that family dynamic, the story of this man and his relationship to love, his relationship to love of himself, love of the other, love of family, his caretaking of his mother, that's the heart, that's the spirit, that's really the body as well of our movie. And it is, while we don't try to convey an answer necessarily to these thorny questions, it is in some ways an answer to the absurdity of the social, of the satirical side of the movie, the tropes and the stereotypes and the kind of weird tragedy I describe of that side of the film, even though it's satirical. Mm-hmm. The answer to all of that is this family that we rarely see in cinema. We rarely see, as you describe, people such as myself, Sterling K. Brown, Tracy Ellis Ross, Leslie Uggams, portraying a family like this. And when I saw the film for the first time with an audience, I looked up at one point and I just said to myself, wow, what beautiful people. So if there is an answer there, and maybe there are several more answers there, but if there is, then that's certainly one of them. That mm-hmm. let's just see the full humanness of who we are, and mm-hmm. let's celebrate.
And we've got about 5 minutes left. You mentioned Sterling K. Brown. He was nominated for an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, and his character is a riot. So let me try to get you on two things in the 5 minutes that we have left. You have played several real life figures throughout your career: Jean-Michel Basquiat, Colin Powell, Martin Luther King, Muddy Waters, and most recently Adam Clayton Powell in the movie Rustin. And Jeremy, I have to tell you, I did
Jeffrey,
not you
Jeffrey you, Jonathan.
Yeah.
Oh, you said Jeremy. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
That's right. That's right.
Jeffrey, you were so good and basically disappeared. I did not realize it was you until the credits.
That was Jeremy.
Stop messing with me. how difficult is it to play such well-known figures, both in American history, American culture, but particularly in Black history and Black culture?
You mean Adam Clayton Powell?
Of them. Jean-Michel Basquiat, Colin Powell, Martin Luther King. These are huge figures in history.
Well, yeah, there's a greater level of responsibility to those characters because these are... Yeah, real lives. And I do try to the extent that I can to do, you know, their memories justice. So, I take a little extra care with that, obviously. I try to choose people that I'm very interested in, that I have a good deal of respect for. And ultimately, what I find when I work on, particularly on the story of Jean-Michel Basquiat or Muddy Waters or any of these people, really, I find a love for them. And it's out of that, you know, sense of respect and appreciation for them that I'm able to kind of dig deeper into the tales of who they are and in the ideal, bring those to bear when I tell their stories. There's so many wonderful, wonderful characters in our history. Jean-Michel Basquiat was not very well known before that film came out to the world outside of the art world. So, yeah, it took good care in kind of introducing some part of his story to people who hadn't previously known of him. But there are so many more characters back in our history who haven't had that light shined on them, who have incredible stories waiting to be told. So, It's just rich with story there, and I'm hoping maybe if people have appreciated that I've worked in that way, maybe there are other actors out there who will work in that way and go back and find even more of these wonderful men and women and bring their stories to light as well.
In previous interviews, you've said that Basquiat and American Fiction are films that bookend your career. I'm looking at the clock. We've got just a minute left. And so I can't have this conversation with you, Jeffrey, without asking you, what does it mean to be, to receive an Oscar nomination for your role in American Fiction?
It's pretty cool. I've been really moved because this is recognition from my peers. Not only for my work, but for Sterling's work and for the entire film, which is cool too, because that represents everyone who worked on this movie. But in that, this comes from our peers, and they've looked at what we've done and said, yeah, we like that. And we like the work that you've done for a long time. It's really gratifying. And I'm super, super appreciative. Yeah.
This has been great. I don't know if a lot of people know this. Jeffrey Wright is a Washington, Washington native. You went to St. Albans, right?
I did. Yeah,
went to St. Albans, played lacrosse. So the Washington Post is your hometown newspaper. So I am doubly thrilled to welcome you to Washington Post Live. Jeffrey Wright, Oscar-nominated lead actor in the Oscar-nominated Best Picture American Fiction. Thank you so much for coming to KPART on Washington Post Live.
Thank you for having me, Jonathan. Southeast DC represent.
Thanks for listening to KPART. This week's episode was edited by Quarry Alleen. We'll have new episodes for you every Thursday. I'm Jonathan KPART. You can find me on X at KPARTJ.
If you're looking for a smoking gun, I can absolutely guarantee you will not find it.
In October 2001, a series of letters filled with a deadly powder called anthrax were dropped into the U.S. mail system. What started as an unprecedented case turned into an unsettling mystery. Who sent these deadly letters, and why? From Campside Media and Sony Music Entertainment, I'm Josh Dean, and this is Cover Up Season 4, The Anthrax Threat, available now.